Jesus must have depressed his disciples when he spoke the words recorded in Luke 17:1, saying, "Temptations to sin are sure to come." Sure to come this week at work. Although we may resolve on Sunday morning that we will avoid all temptations to sin, they are inevitable. They will be there, and not just at work, but at home as well. For even though there are those who seek to cloister themselves away from the onslaughts of worldly temptation, they find that no matter where their home may be, nor how isolated they may become, that those temptations are there nevertheless. Even when we are able to close off the environment of our immediate home, they are present even in the recesses, the privacy, and the secrecy of our own minds. They are there when we gather together as God's people in the name of Jesus Christ. In fact, even here in a worship service of all times and of all places, temptations even here and now, temptations to sin, are sure to come. When his disciples heard that, I would assume that that was difficult news to listen to. Because there is a sense in all of us who are committed to God, a sense of a desire that someday we will round the corner. Someday we will make it over the peak, and someday we will be home free, and no longer will the temptations be present. Jesus seems to shatter all that with the announcement that temptations are sure to come, and his disciples respond in the fifth verse of Luke 17, saying, "Increase our faith." In other words, God, give us help and give us hope. Now, it was in the context of this declaration that temptations are sure to come that Jesus spoke a 97-word parable. A parable that, in my opinion, is a strange and somewhat difficult parable. Unlike many of the others that we have studied, it is not so upbeat nor so encouraging. And I suppose there would be an inclination at least to skip over this one and to only go with those that lift our hearts and spirits and think that this one ought to be excluded because at first reading at least it seems to be downright bleak. But upon more careful study, we find that here again Jesus has given to us the potential of great encouragement for us as disciples of Jesus Christ. Well, listen to the 97 words recorded in the parable of Luke 17, verses 7 to 10. Jesus says, "Will any of you who has a servant plowing or keeping sheep say to him when he has come in from the field, 'Come at once and sit down at table'? Will he not rather say to him, 'Prepare supper for me and gird yourself and serve me till I eat and drink, and afterwards you shall eat and drink'? Does he thank the servant because he did what was commanded? So you also, when you have done all that is commanded you, say, 'We are unworthy servants. We have only done what was our duty.'" Now, typical of Jesus in his parables, he once again uses common phenomena of his day. We have seen that parable principle again and again. When he takes ordinary things and uses them as instruments to communicate his truth, many of them cast in the setting of the poverty of Palestine in the first century. You recall that one of the parables is about a widow woman who received tremendous injustice in the court system of her day and who insisted on going again and again to a judge, pleading with him to at least hear her case and decide in a just fashion. Or you recall the account of the man who had company unexpectedly arrive in the middle of the night and who opened his cupboard only as a poor man to find that there was no food there to give to the visitors who had arrived. Or maybe you remember the parable of the poor woman who lost a single little coin and who would not stop until she had found it, who lighted a light in the middle of the night, who swept her house clean, who would do anything and everything until at last she could find that single little coin again. Poverty was harsh and hard there in the first century, as poverty is harsh and hard in every century. but especially difficult was the lot of a slave. For a slave was at the lowest rung of the ladder. It was the worst. And some may think that Jesus, in using this as an example, condones slavery, which surely he does not. Some may even go so far as to think that hereby he endorses it, which is clearly not the case. He was seeking to communicate truth. And in his parables, he used that which the people were familiar with, and one of the things they were familiar with was the slave. Everyone knew about slaves. Everyone knew that a slave worked hard. Everyone knew that a slave's time was not his own, that he had no jurisdiction over his schedule nor his task. He didn't even own his own body. Everything was dictated by his master, so that by contrast, when a freed man would do a hard day's labor, he could come home and he could collapse on the floor and rest and have his dinner. But not so for a slave. For no matter how diligently a slave had labored all the day long, when he would come home, he would have a whole new list of inside chores to follow the outside chores that he had already done. Every task he had led to another task until life became a miserable drudgery, and even though he performed exceptionally well, in all probability, the average master would never even say thank you. Now, if you're one of those people who seek to put a logic together to things, you may wonder. You may find it fascinating, maybe you find it impossible, that Jesus should combine the concept of temptation to sin, always coming, with a parable that deals with the way a slave functions in everyday Palestinian society. But there is a connection that was clearly present in Jesus' mind. For he knew that his followers, whether first century or 20th, would have temptations to sin that were clearly correlated to their service as disciples of Jesus Christ. He knew that there would be some who would become weary in well-doing, so fatigued that they wanted to quit, that there would be those who, because they did not receive the gratitude which they thought they had coming to them, would become bitter as a result, and that there would be still others in the service of Jesus Christ as disciples who bear his name, who would think that once their duty was done, that they had gained a special worthiness before God which deserved God's accolades and God's gracious response. Yeah, there's a connection. There's a correlation between that which Jesus says that depresses his disciples in verse 1 and the parable that he tells in verses 7 through 10. But let me tell you that here is a parable that, to my way of thinking at least, is as relevant as today's news. A parable that honestly speaks to what we have been watching on Nightline and reading in the Minneapolis Star and Tribune about Christian leaders who have gotten into severest of difficulties. Here's a parable that is as relevant as the consideration of a Sunday school teacher somewhere in America, if not here in this building this Sunday morning, the last of May, who is thinking about quitting because after 9 months of service, there has not been a parent nor a child who has said thank you. Here is a parable that is relevant to those who have diligently served in the cause of Jesus Christ in some distant mission field for the better part of a lifetime, and because of the service they have given, have themselves rated themselves as better than others. It is a parable that is relevant, strangely enough, because it speaks of duty in a time when duty is not a popular concept. A parable that urges perseverance when many of us are more inclined to quit than to hang in there. A parable that is about serving, when serving is a major employer of our society, but we tend to want to think of it more in terms of others serving us than us serving others. It is, in the connection of what Jesus was here talking about, a parable that tells us to do duty, but to do it without sinning. It is a parable that presents, to my understanding of it, three tough truths. Truths that we may not be inclined much to listen to nor to hear, but truths that we need to hear. Tough truths from the lips of Jesus Christ, whom we acknowledge as our Savior and Lord. Tough truths that are here, ready or not. tough truth number one in verses 7 and 8 is that duty never finishes. Let's go back again to read those 7th and 8th verses where Jesus speaks in the parable some questions, asking, will any one of you who has a servant plowing or keeping sheep say to him when he has come in from the field, come at once and sit down at table? Well, they all knew that there was no master that did that. They all knew there wasn't a master who invited his slave at the end of the day to come and enjoy a meal that had been prepared for him. Will he not rather say to him, hey, you, prepare supper for me. Gird yourself and serve me till I eat and I drink. Yeah, and then afterwards, if there's time, you shall eat and drink. The Greek word that is used here is the word doulos, and although in many of our English Bibles it is translated as servant, it may rightly be translated as slave. Slave. Over whom the master had complete control of every detail of life. We think of slavery as something that was a phenomenon of a certain era of our own country's history, sometimes forgetting that slavery has been around the world and through time for all of history, and that there are many places in the world today where people are as enslaved as the worst of any history's report. Slaves don't work 8-hour days. They don't finish in the field or in the fold and they're done and they come home and they relax. When a slave finishes one task, all there is another task. And when that is finished, all there is yet another task. The master seeks to get all of the economic benefit that he possibly can out of those who are his slaves. They go immediately from chore to chore, and it never, 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 never ends. That seems so hopeless. And there's a sense in which it is. For we look to a vacation, or to a day off, or to a promotion, or some transition, thinking I can get through the tough times knowing that around the corner, over the peak of the hill, then everything will be all right, but not for a slave. A slave's task never ends. His duty is never finished. All there ever is more. Oh, I know that to us that seems difficult, but it also seems distant. Something that we read out of a history book, or if it is contemporary today, it's something that we would read in the back pages of National Geographic. But actually, the principle is something that does apply to our lives. For although we are not slaves, those of us who are called to various duties often find that those duties are never finished. Parents find that they begin their day with the care of a child that needs to be prepared for the going off to school or whatever the activities may include. But in order to prepare that child, the parent needs to get up before the child and do certain self-tasks and home chores. And then after the child is ready, then the parent goes off to work and has a difficult and demanding day herself or himself, comes home weary, exhausted, fatigued, ready to collapse, only to find that there are children who have wounds that need to be bound, homework that needs to be done, lives that need to be loved, a whole new agenda. And just when you're ready to finish, you find that duty never finishes. For when that task is finished, there is more to do until finally at some late hour, long after dark has come, you're ready to collapse in a bed with too many hours gone by and too few hours before the alarm goes off and the process begins all over again. And so those who are in those circumstances understand that duty never finishes. The same is the case in ministry. There are those who agree to have an impact upon the lives of others as teachers of Sunday school, sometimes thinking that it is a commitment that is for an hour on a Sunday morning, 52 times. And even before that commitment was made, there was the struggle of whether or not the teacher was willing to be tied down for that long and lose freedom to someone else. But maybe with a sense of duty, maybe with a sense of reluctance, it was agreed to. Only to find that it was more complex than that. The duty never finishes with the end of the class. That there are children in that class whose lives become entwined with the teacher's life. Who come from homes where there are problems. Who have physical maladies that were never anticipated. Spiritual questions that were not in the teacher's manual. And so the duty that was once thought to be limited to an hour becomes something that is stretched out throughout the week. And even when the school year comes to an end, that teacher finds there has not only been fulfillment, but there has been an extension of duty. Until that child's life becomes a part of the teacher's life, and duty never finishes. Or there's that person for whom you agree to pray, thinking that the problem will be short-lived and you will utter a few brief prayers for a few brief days, only to find that the stressful time in that individual's life is chronic. And what started out as a simple thing becomes a complicated and a protracted thing. And so you end up praying for that person every single day for a year and maybe for a decade and perhaps for a lifetime, because the duty of intercession is never finished. Or you may have agreed to give financial support in some small amount to someone who is a friend and agrees to a short term of missionary service, perhaps only for 6 months or a year, maybe even for less than that. And you find that the duty that you thought was only a part of this year's budget extends beyond that, for that individual senses the call of God to become a career missionary and give a whole lifetime to the service of Jesus Christ and the reaching of his people. But then you discover that when that duty has been extended, that the dollar devalues, and what started out as a comfortable commitment, if duty is met, becomes an uncomfortable commitment to financially underwrite the person who is out there and dependent upon you and the resources that you have extended. And we begin to live and understand in the context of parenting, of Christian ministry, of life, the duty never finishes. There was a physician named Grenfell who worked in the distant reaches of Labrador in northeastern Canada, who wrote his story telling how he was called to a home where there was a man and a woman who were desperately ill and he needed to tend to them medically, which was his duty as a physician. After an arduous journey, he arrived there, only to find that their malady was so far progressed that he tended not to their sickness but to their deaths. And they died all too quickly. Well, his duty was done, or so he thought, until Dr. Grenfell found that there was no one who would take responsibility for their bodies, that there was no one who would provide for a funeral or a burial. And so he lingered on. And he provided for the funeral, paid for it himself. He took care of the burial personally, knowing that he had gone far beyond his initial duty as a physician and thinking then that he was finished. But he wrote on that he found himself with five little mortals sitting on the grave mound. We thought that we had done all that could be expected of a doctor, but now we found the difference. It looked as if God expected more. And so it is with Christian duty. For we discover that when we commit ourselves to Jesus Christ, we become his doulos, his servants, his slaves, and that he often expects more and more. Did I not say that that's a tough truth? It is a tough truth. Tough not only because duty never finishes, but also tough because we become tempted to think that God does not care. We become tempted to sin in the weariness of well-doing. Tempted to sin when duty piles upon duty until we think that we are going to collapse under the responsibilities that have been laid upon us. And we think that God has abandoned us. That he is like the master in the parable who has forgotten, who does not care. Now, to be sure, that is the farthest from the truth. For we know that in Jesus Christ was and is one who, although equal with God, in the form of God, thought equality with God not something to be grasped, but gave all that up and took upon himself the likeness of man and became a doulos, a servant, a slave. The gospel writer tells us that he came not to be served, but to serve. And throughout his service, the pile of duties became greater and greater until one day the Roman soldiers nailed him to a cross. And he must have wondered, for he too was tempted to sin as we are tempted to sin. And he must have wondered if God had not completely forgotten him. He must have wondered if God no longer cared, for did he not cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me? But God cared. God cared deeply that day. Just as God cares for us, even when we feel forsaken. It's a tough truth. Are you up to a tough truth? The tough truth is that duty never finishes. Now, Jesus could have omitted it from his teaching. Luke could have omitted it from his gospel, and surely we could have omitted it from our study of the parables. But it's a truth that we need to hear from Jesus Christ. He wants us to know that around the next corner is not always the escape that we anticipate. And it is not always the case that if we make it up to the top of this mountain, we will then be over the other side and it'll be downhill from there. For sometimes in life we discover in the course of our duty that when we reach that peak, we find that it is not the peak of the mountain, but simply the top of the foothill, and there are higher mountains and higher hills that are yet to come. The answer is that we do not sin in the doing of duty that never finishes, but rather that we be like Jesus who chose to delight, as difficult as that may be, in the duty that never finishes. But this is not the only tough truth that our loving Savior shares with us. For he tells us not only that duty never finishes, but adds in verse 9 that duty seeks no thanks. In the parable, he asks a rhetorical question. Does he, that is the master, thank the servant because he did what was commanded? Now, the clearly implied answer to this rhetorical question is no. The slave did not expect, nor in this case, receive thanks from his master. That's hard to live with, not being thanked. You've done good things for people. Things that deserved gratitude where you never received any appreciation. Please understand parabolic teaching in the New Testament, for this is not here saying that God is not grateful for those that serve him well, for indeed he is. It was God himself who coined the phrase, well done, good and faithful servant. But remember also that the context here is about avoiding temptations to sin. And I'll tell you that one of the greatest temptations to sin in the Christian life comes when we think we deserve thanks and we do not receive it. I know that. I know that from experience because I have so sinned. There have been occasions when I have done what I thought to be my very best for people, when I have given my extra effort only to have no one say thank you, only to have no expression of gratitude. And I will confess to you that there have been times in those circumstances where I have allowed that lack of expression of gratitude to be turned in my heart into bitterness and resentment. And what started out as a grand opportunity to be God's instrument in someone else's life turned out to be a festering infection of the soul and the sin of resentment and bitterness because no one said thank you. Now look, I'm not alone in this. My guess is that nearly all of us have experienced the very same thing. You can take it into almost any arena of life. There are parents of adult children who have poured themselves into their children's lives, no doubt about it, who have sacrificed astonishingly on behalf of their children, only to have their children arrive in adulthood and not only not say thanks, but be clearly ungrateful for all that their parents have done. Tragically, though, there are parents who, under those circumstances, have allowed the love they once had for their children to turn into hatred for those very same children because they succumbed to the temptation to sin. As servants of Jesus Christ, who expected thanks. There are wives who have sinned against their husbands and against God because they resented the fact that their husbands were not appreciative of all that they had done. To be sure, they should have been appreciative. No doubt about that. But they have allowed the lack of gratitude on behalf of themselves from their husbands to turn into that type of a cancer and infection of the soul. There are Christians who have quit serving God because people in the church never said thank you. Thank you for teaching Sunday school or ushering or singing in the choir or giving money or providing for prayer or cooking or whatever the need may be. And because they were never thanked, they allowed that to become the cause, the succumbing to the temptation to sin. There are missionaries, some of whom I know, who left this country as zealous idealists, going out to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ with an enthusiasm that was contagious, and have gotten off into some distant land where they have, without a doubt, sacrificed their lives. It may not have been in a sudden death, but in some cases it was in a protracted death. They gave their lives for people who in the end resented their ever coming. And even Christians, who because of those missionaries' work, will spend eternity in heaven but never took the time to say thank you or express appreciation for what they have done. And so those same missionaries have on occasion become so resentful for those to whom God had given them charge that they return back to their homeland bitter and disillusioned and angry. Understand that we all have deep-seated need to be recognized and appreciated. And I hope that we understand that. I hope that we do that. I hope that when you come into a worship service on a Sunday morning here or in any other church and an usher shows you to a seat or gives you a bulletin that you say thank you. I would encourage you that when you pick up your children at the nursery this morning that you say thank you to those that work there, that at the end of the school year you send a note to your children's teachers in Sunday school and in the public or private school and express appreciation for all that they have done for them. All of that is good and right. But where the trouble comes is when we as Christians, as servants, as doulos of Jesus Christ, expect that thanks, and when we do not receive it, turn bitter. It's a tough truth. A tough truth that Jesus needs for us to know, that we need to know. The tough truth that duty seeks no thanks. There is a third and a final tough truth in the 10th verse. The tough truth that duty doesn't make worthiness. And it speaks to yet another temptation to sin in the doing of duty. That is the temptation to think that because we do our duty, we are worthy of God. It is a sin that is variously expressed. There are those who say, God owes me. I have given to him. I have given to him money. I have given to him time. I have given to him prayers. I have been faithful in diligently serving fellow humankind and involvement in church and charity. And now I have come to a crisis in my own life where the medical problem is not solvable by the physicians, where the family distress is not remediable by some family conference, where we need direct intervention from God, and we say, God, you owe me for all that I have done. I am worthy of your intervention, and so demand it. For those who say, I deserve it. I have been involved for years in doing what God has called me to do. I have been a faithful servant, and I expect then recognition here on earth, even preferential treatment in heaven. There's some who, although they would probably not say it, actually think, I'm better. Look at all that I have done through all the years, all the service that I have offered. Look at what she hasn't done. Look at what he started to do and never finished. I'm better than them all. How tragically mixed up such conclusions are. For when we think such things and we say such words, we have neglected the truth that we are sinners. Sinners. That if we got what we really deserved, we would be eternally lost without God in a Christless hell. That he has redeemed us by his generosity and grace. And that he has added to that the stunning privilege of being his servants and living for him. That our lives are expressions of gratitude for that which he did for us that we never deserved. Our duty is not something that causes us to have opportunity to be elevated in our sight or God's. Our service is simply the thank you that we offer to a God who has done everything for us. Maybe it's best expressed in a parable of our own. A certain man was on a death boat, destined to go to an island where every one of the prisoners on that boat were to be executed by legal decree. But this certain man was so belligerent to his fellow prisoners and to the guards that the guards concocted a scheme to throw him overboard and let him die in the waves and the foam of mid-sea and never make it to the gallows of the execution island. And so they did. Threw him over, yelling and screaming, swearing and protesting. They did not anticipate that he would stay afloat long enough to be seen by someone on the bow of a luxury liner that came by not too long afterwards. And when that lookout conveyed word to the captain of the ship, the captain of the ship decided in his goodness to stop, to pick up the condemned man, and not only rescue him, but also offer him a job for the rest of his life working in the marvelous conditions of that luxury liner. It was 3 months later when it was obvious that that once rescued man had turned into a bitter and a miserable person. His reasons were three. Number one, because it was a lot of work to do on the ship. And whenever he finished his work, there was always more work to do on the ship. And it increased and increased until he became resentful that he could not spend time on the Lido deck with the paying passengers and all the comforts that were there. Reason number two was that the captain seldom came around either to his quarters nor to his workstation to thank him for the fine job that he was doing and to express gratitude for having him aboard the ship and a member of the crew. And his third reason was that he was disappointed that he, because of the excellence of his duty and his diligence, was not given preferential treatment aboard the ship and as a member of the crew and fully recognized for his worthiness as a part of the ship's family. Now, when word of all of this reached the captain, he, on short order, found his way to the once rescued man and spoke to him with kindness, but also with sternness. He gave to him some pointed advice. He said to him, "You need to understand that you don't even deserve to be here on this ship. Would you rather that you were thrown back overboard? Do you understand that you are the one who ought to be grateful that you are here aboard this boat, that you are the one who should be saying thank you? And that when you have done this duty, wherein you have life and opportunity for gratitude, you ought to say, I am an unworthy servant. I have only done what was my duty." At the beginning, I said that these were tough truths, and I think they are. But tough truths that we need to hear. We dare not forget that we have been saved from sin by the grace of God. We dare not forget that we are highly privileged, honored to serve God. And so let us not turn that honor into sin by stooping to wrong attitudes that turn us bitter. But rather, oh, much rather, let us thrill to the delight that is ours, and it is a delight. A delight to do our duty as disciples of Jesus Christ. To do our duty even when duty is never finished. To do our duty even when we do not hear thanks. Most of all, let us do our duty and not think ourselves worthy of Him who is most worthy of all. Worthy of worship and adoration. Let us do our duty with delight and without sinning. Will you stand and pray together with me?